Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia on the planet, affecting close to 6 million people in the United States alone. But almost two-thirds of all these people are actually women. So for every man suffering from Alzheimer's, there are two women.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Lisa Mosconi, and she's here to talk to us about her new book called The XX Brain, which is all about women's health and women's brains. Why is it that women are twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's? Or why is it that women are twice as likely to have anxiety and depression compared to men? She's going to tell us why and what we can do. It's a fascinating conversation. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset, all with the goal of helping you understand how your brain is not broken. I'm your host, Drew Prode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Dr. Lisa Mosconi. Dr. Mosconi is the director of the Women's Brain Initiative and Associate Director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College, where she serves as an Associate Professor of Neuroscience in Neurology and Radiology. In addition, she's an adjunct faculty member at NYU's Department of Psychiatry and the author of Brain Food and the recently released The XX Brain. Dr. Mosconi, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You've been definitely on our list as somebody. I couldn't think of a better guest to have on here. First of all, 75% of our listeners on this podcast are women.
Oh, great.
But even the men, I think this is an important topic.
Absolutely.
Because we need to know how to take care of all the loved ones in our life.
Yes.
So I want to start off with a few stats that your team sent over to us from your book.
Yes.
So number one, women are twice as likely to have anxiety and depression as men. Women are over three times more likely than men to be diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder, including those that attack the brain, like multiple sclerosis. Women are four times more likely to suffer from migraines and headaches than men. And women are more prone than men to developing some of the most common brain tumors. And I'm just getting started. There's a whole host that's out there.
Yes.
When people hear stats like this, and you've been such a great advocate for women of raising the alarm, what's your goal in sharing those stats?
Well, the goal is definitely not to have anybody panic, right? The point is to acknowledge that women's brains have different risks and different strengths than men's brains, and that their brains are not exactly the same. There are some perhaps subtle differences that are, however, very important for our health. So we really need to talk about women's brains. And I think as a scientist, I'm very much aware that there's a strong gender bias in medicine. And, you know, today we're talking more and more about equality. And perhaps it doesn't take a scientist to denounce the fact that women's financial, legal, and even physical security remains today inequitable. But it does take a scientist to denounce the fact that women are also overlooked medically, where our needs go way too often unacknowledged and unaddressed. And this is particularly true in the field of neurology, which is my field. So neurology and neuroscience. We never, ever talk about women's brains other than to make fun of them.
Wow.
That's true.
Interesting. Can you expand on the last point? So other than to make fun.
As a society. When women say, you know, not women, but when people say, oh, you're hormonal today, or she's in a bad mood, she must be PMS. Yes.
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 Yes. That's so true.
I think we really
it's so
need
embedded
to,
into society.
Mm-hmm, and we really need to change the conversation, because there are things that we need to understand about women's brains that are not part of the conversation at this point, and many scientists and many doctors are just becoming aware that gender medicine is an actual thing. It's a very, very important discipline in medicine, but that's usually confined to other parts of the body. So for me, I'm really trying to raise awareness that there is a gender neurology that needs to happen.
That's beautiful. And from somebody who studied it, give us a little bit of like the history. Why is it that way?
Right.
You know, you say it as that we've been practicing something called bikini medicine.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is? And how did we end up in this position?
Yes. Yeah. So, and to be clear, I'm not saying that there's a conspiracy against women. It just so happened that many decisions were made historically that led to women's brains being overlooked in medicine. And so basically, still today, we teach and practice bikini medicine, which is this rather unfortunate term that describes how historically medical professionals believed that men and women were essentially the same person with different reproductive organs, those parts of the body that can fit under a bikini. Therefore, the term bikini medicine, which is, you know, something I just used in the book to make the point. But the consequence was that setting those parts aside, as if one could, really meant the doctors would diagnose and treat both genders the same exact way. And that has consequences. That really has consequences. For example, if you ask a doctor to look at a female patient under the lens of women's health, right, the field of medicine, the women's health field, they might do a pap test to check for cancer, your cervix for cancer. If you're over 40, they might suggest that you start doing mammograms. They might run blood tests to check your hormone levels for your fertility or causes of infertility, for example. But once again, women's health is restricted to the health of our reproductive organs, which is strongly believed to be a consequence of a reductive understanding of what a woman is in the first place. And from where I sit as the founder and director of the Women's Brain Initiative at Weill Cornell in New York City, there's one part of the body that really deserves our full attention that will never fit under a bikini, which is really our brain.
It's so powerful. And I can't think of a better way to lead that conversation than to jump into the topic of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you missed one thing in the statistic.
Yes,
thing, right?
I left it off on purpose.
Thank you.
I left it off on purpose because I can't think of another area where it's more profound than that. So tell us, what do we know about the stats around Alzheimer's and when it comes to the gender divide?
Right. So Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia on the planet, affecting close to 6 million people in the United States alone. But almost two-thirds of all these people are actually women. So for every man suffering from Alzheimer's, there are two women. And that's on top of the higher risk of anxiety and depression, or multiple sclerosis, or meningiomas, like you mentioned, which are the most common brain tumors. Women are also much more likely to die of a stroke. If a stroke takes place, we're more likely to have aneurysms as we go through menopause, especially. And Alzheimer's is just, it's enormous. There are so many people with Alzheimer's, and if we don't find a solution, then the rates of Alzheimer's disease are going to triple by the year 2050, with a projected 15 million patients in the United States alone, which is, for context, the populations of New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles put together. So it's an enormous amount of people, and two-thirds of all those people might end up being women.
Yeah, you said before in a talk that I watched in preparation of this interview, you say just because we're living longer, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're always living healthier.
Yes, and that's actually also the problem we have in Alzheimer's disease. Then, for many years, I was trying to study this gender disparity in Alzheimer's, and people would just say to me, well, you know, that's just because women live longer, right? So Alzheimer's disease is a disease of old age, and women live longer, so it goes without saying that you get Alzheimer's more, and that's the end of it.
Right, you know, that was like, the conclusion that was accepted in science for a long time.
For a really long time, and things are starting to change dramatically, finally, in part because we now understand that Alzheimer's is not a disease of old age. So we associate Alzheimer's with the elderly because the symptoms of Alzheimer's emerge when people are older, usually in their 70s. But in reality, Alzheimer's disease starts with negative changes in the brain years, if not decades, prior to clinical symptoms. So we started to look at that midlife. Midlife seems to be when these brain changes really start taking place. And so since my background is in brain imaging, I have a PhD in neuroscience, but also in nuclear medicine. So I do brain scans for a living, physically and in my lab. And with the Women's Brain Initiative, we do brain scans on all of our participants. And we started going younger and younger. When I started, we were looking at patients who were like 65, maybe 70. And then I was like, well, you know, we have to really start looking at people who are like in their 40s. And so now we have hundreds and hundreds of participants who are like 40 to 65, for example. And we did brain scans on all of them. And then we compared the brains, so men and women. And we showed that women's brains in midlife look much more Alzheimer-ish than men's brains, which means, in other words, that women with a predisposition to Alzheimer's disease start developing Alzheimer's earlier than men do. Which is quite
unsettling.
It's unsettling,
but it's yes. So important to realize.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about some of the factors that lead to that. But
right.
I actually want to just take this back to your personal story before we continue further.
Yeah.
Because you have a
Why are you doing that, right?
You have a personal connection to this. It's not just your area of research. It's
yeah.
also personal history. Can you share a little bit about your family background and history when it comes to women's health and things like Alzheimer's?
Yes. So I have a family history of Alzheimer's disease that seems to affect the women in my family quite strongly. My grandmother was one of four siblings, three sisters and one brother. And all three sisters developed and died of dementia, whereas the brother was spared, which was quite a thing. I was born and raised in Florence in Italy, and there is no assisted living in Italy, especially not back then. So my grandmother basically lived with us. She had her own apartment, but it was literally on the same landing as our apartment. And my mom was the primary caregiver, clearly, and all of us, we really helped. And it was just so present for so many years, because Alzheimer's is a very insidious disease. It starts very slowly, and at some point, the patient just can't live on their own anymore. They really need assistance 100% of the time, and there are some good days and bad days.
It becomes all-consuming for the caretakers.
It's a very long process, and I lived through most of it until I moved to New York to do my PhD. And my mom then really suffered also the isolation that so many caregivers experience, because I wasn't there, my dad was helping, but it's a little bit different, I think, when usually women are the primary caregivers of Alzheimer's patients. It's about 2/3 of all caregivers for Alzheimer's patients are women. And there's also evidence that women experience more caregiver burden in terms of stress and stress reaction than a male caregiver, which again is not in any way to discount the suffering that a male patient or a male caregiver would go through. Absolutely, that's not the point. It's just I lived it from the women's side of the story. So that's what really kind of scared me. Very honestly, it really scared me. And I was in college when that happened, and I said, I need to study Alzheimer's. I need to understand what's happening and how to prevent it for my mom, for myself, for my daughter now, and for my friends. And so I've been doing it since, 20 years and counting.
How was your mom's health as she continued to age?
My mom?
Yes, your
mom. Oh, my mom, well, knocking on wood, she's doing fantastic. She really embraced everything I've been telling her about prevention.
All the things
Alzheimer's
that you would
disease.
Research and find
yes.
out and how to support her brain,
yeah,
you would share that with her.
Yeah, I shared with her, and she's a very present mom, my mom. So everything I do, she's very involved with. She's a scientist too. My parents are both nuclear physicists. So she actually introduced me to the nuclear medicine team where I studied, where I did my PhD. So she really understands the science, and she's always been super involved in my work. And when I started, nobody was talking about prevention for Alzheimer's disease. Nobody believed that prevention was even feasible.
It was almost a little bit taboo.
Oh my goodness.
Like, why are you talking about this other area? Like, yes. There's no research that's out there. There's nothing there. It's not even worth getting into.
Yes, they really, there was a lot of suspicion, almost like your reputation was at stake if you mentioned the word prevention, you know. But still today, when we publish papers that use the word prevention, sometimes we get flagged as something that hasn't been proven. So we have to switch to risk reduction. Mm. That is accepted. But we're getting there. But so going back to my mom, she's amazing. My parents live in Italy, so they follow a very healthy diet. They're very physically active. They're very intellectually active. They're still teaching. And my mom goes to yoga twice a week. She can do a headstand. She's over 70. She's doing everything right. She's doing everything right.
A lot of, younger folks go through the experience, especially if they're into health and wellness, that they start to read these things. And in your case, you're actually researching these things.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's very tricky to navigate how to best take care of your parents. And are they open-minded and will they listen?
Yeah.
To pivot real quick before we come back to the narrative, is there anything that you've seen that's been very useful that your mom is open-minded to integrating these ideas and thoughts that you have about prevention?
Yes, I think the brain scans I noticed that more and more people, including our own patients, they really feel more connected with their brains after seeing brain scans that show a difference, like before and after. This is kind of the work I've been doing for a long time, not just in women, but just in terms of Alzheimer's prevention. We would do brain scans of people who follow one diet or another diet and then follow them over time and repeat the brain scans. You can literally see how people on the Western diet, for example, their brains are just aging so much faster as compared to people who are on healthier diets. And it's very real. You can see just by eyeballing these brain scans. You can see one brain showing signs of shrinkage and the other brain being just nice and full. And most often than not, the brain that's shrinking is on a bad diet. So I think that is very empowering when you can see that in general, but also when you can see your own brain, right? If we can show that your brain energy levels are not as high as they should be for age, or if you're showing some signs of brain shrinkage, and these are all the things that you can do to slow it down, I find it to be a really strong motivator.
In the context of your mom, did she get a chance to come to your clinic and do some of those
tests? No, unfortunately,
she just read about the research that you guys put out there.
Yes, and I've shown her a lot of brain scans of our participants, but she doesn't live in the United States, so right. A little bit tricky to do research on people who are not quite,
Yeah, it's a little tougher.
Yeah, and now she's outside of my age range.
Yeah. So I want to come back to the place that we started things off with, which is raising the alarm, truly,
yes.
That we need to give attention to this topic.
Yes.
And we need to make sure that we're looking at how are women's brains different so that we can support them and not exclude them from the conversation.
Yeah.
So give us some of the fundamentals for the folks that are listening. What are some of the ways that men's and women's brains might be different and how that impacts what diseases we get in our later years?
Yes, that's a really good question. And I just want to mention that there are a lot of pop science-y, hand-wavy theories on how women's brains are different from men's brains. And I just want to be very, very clear that from a scientist's perspective, there is no evidence of a gendered brain. So I just want to put it out there because I got this question a few times that men are from Mars.
Right.
Girls are from Venus. This is something that leaves me obviously like, whoa, yeah, I don't know about any of that. However.
Totally. And it's not even like the brain is, there's like not like a male brain and then a women's brain.
Yes.
It's how the body interacts with
Thank
the brain.
Thank you. Yes. So what's really important is that we're different systems. We're wired a little bit differently. And that starts from the very moment of conception. So if you are a female, meaning if you have two X chromosomes, which has nothing to do with gender identity, is just really to use a word that we use in clinical practice. If you have two X chromosomes, technically, you're a female, and if you have an X and a Y, you're male, and so is your brain, right? What's interesting is that the X chromosome is bigger than the Y chromosome. It has like 1,098 genes, whereas the Y chromosome only has 78. So if you are a double X, you have 1,000 more genes to start with, and many are involved in reproduction and fertility, but others are really involved in brain health. And it's really important to know that, because your DNA is what really makes your hormones. And hormones are one of the very first factors that matter for the sexual differentiation of the brain. So as the little brain is maturing, if you have more androgens flowing in your bloodstream and in your cells, then you're going to have more of a male brain. Whereas if you have the XX and more estrogens, you're going to develop a female brain. So the architecture of the brain is very similar, but the functionality is slightly different just because of this to start with. And this, you're not even born at that point. You're still inside your mama's belly and you're just growing a brain. And once the child is born, then the differences obviously become even more pronounced because of all the interactions with the environment and all the things that happen to girls and boys, right, all the way through adolescence. And then the biggest events in a woman's life being pregnancy, you know, being pregnant and carrying a child has profound effects on your body and your brain as well. And then going through menopause, which is quite a shock to this finely tuned system. And these are all neuroendocrine transition stages, which means that your brain and your endocrine system, your hormones, are both in transition at the same time. And we now understand that these transition states are very important for brain health, especially in women.
So let's go to that example that you were sharing before, because it used to be thought that, okay, because women are living longer, that's why they're experiencing some of these diseases like Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And then in a lot of the research that's out there, including the work that you did, you're saying that in midlife is when we're starting to see some of the earliest changes in
yes.
the brain. So what are some of the earliest changes? Let's talk about the female brain for a second.
Yeah.
What are some of the early changes?
Do you want to see it?
Yeah, I would love to see it. Okay, right. Fantastic. So you passed me your phone, and I'm looking at the difference,
yes.
everybody that's listening to the podcast,
yes.
of explain what we have on the left and what we have on the right.
So these are positron emission tomography scans, or PET scans, which is a nuclear medicine technique in which we use radioactive isotopes that go up in the brain and look at brain energy levels. And that's literally a map or a visual of how well the brain is metabolizing glucose to produce energy. And the brain to the left belongs to a woman who was 43 years old when we scanned her the first time, and she was premenopausal then. And that brain is exactly what you want your brain to look like when you're 43, or in your 40s. Really nice and bright with a lot of red, right, everywhere in the brain. It's very symmetrical and it's quite red and yellow. The other brain is the same woman, just 7-8 years later, after she went through menopause. And I think you can see quite easily how the red turned yellow, basically green, on the outside of the brain. That's a 30% drop in brain energy levels.
Mm.
And this is not just that one woman. This is the average.
This is
what happens to women as they go through menopause. And interestingly enough, this does not happen to a man of the same age.
Right.
The man's brain looks more like the scan to the left and remains that way throughout midlife, unless, of course, there's always exceptions. But on average, men's brain energy levels are nice and high and pretty much consistent throughout midlife, whereas for women, there's a very marked change during the menopause transition.
And we'll include the image in the show notes, and obviously for those that are watching on YouTube, you can see it. We'll splice it in. Patrick will throw it in the mix. So let's talk about that, because this is a perfect example of what changes over time.
Yeah.
So what happened from one scan to the next? What is happening in the postmenopausal state for yes. women that is leading to less efficient ability to work and produce through energy mm-hmm. in the brain?
Yes. Well, a lot of things happen. The most impactful of which is that estradiol levels plummet. Estradiol is the most potent form of estrogen. and is the number one hormone that we lose during menopause. Now, why is that important? Because we think of estrogens or testosterone as sex hormones, but in reality, these hormones have a very important function in the brain. They're not just involved with reproduction or having kids. They also serve a number of functions that have everything to do with brain energy. Estradiol, in particular, is a neuroprotective hormone, and we call it a master regulator in the female brain. So it's really involved in a number of functions, starting with energy production, but also in growth, plasticity, and even immunity. It really supports the immune system. So it's kind of a superpower that this hormone has, if you will. And once you lose it, the brain loses a very strong ally, right? It's like this hormone is energizing the brain, is keeping the brain young and plastic. And once you lose it, what can happen is that your neurons slow down because they lose energy levels and start aging faster. And studies have shown that this process can even lead to the formation of amyloid plaques or Alzheimer's plaques in women's brains as we go through menopause. And what something that is important to clarify is that we associate menopause with the ovaries, right? We think of menopause as something that makes you infertile, like you can't have kids anymore, so it's your ovaries shutting down and retiring. But when women tell you that they're having hot flashes or night sweats or insomnia or depression or anxiety or brain fog or memory lapses, those symptoms don't start in the ovaries. They start in the brain. They're neurological symptoms. We're just not used to thinking about them as such. And this is really important for two reasons. Number one, because menopause doesn't happen when you're old. Menopause can happen any age between 35 and 60. You know, and the earlier you go through menopause, the more severe these changes can be, or the harder on your body and brain the estrogen loss can be. So it's really important to start the conversation when women are younger, not when you are in menopause, because this is what we do. You wait until you are in menopause, and then the doctor tells you, well, you know, these issues you've been having, you're in menopause, surprise. And then you're like, oh, what do I do now? Right? There's no understanding of why you have the symptoms that you're having, and there's very little understanding of what to do about it. So it's really important, I think, to just talk about it. And also for men, you know, to just know that these things happen to women. They're not just complaining or making it up.
Of course.
It's not of course.
No, of you're course they're not they're... making it up, oh, is what I'm saying.
Can you believe instead
yes,
how
yes.
many
so people,
people
think that they're making it up or
absolutely.
It's this, that. They're, of course they're not making it up. Something is actually happening in the body. And if you have a loved one, your wife, your mother, a cousin, family, friend, whatever it might be, this is why it's so important to be for men to be part of the conversation too.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Part of that conversation and the work that you're focused on is prevention. And part of prevention is understanding what are the factors that make it more likely to have us have a worse state versus not a worse state. So in that instance of menopause and in that instance of estrogen plummeting and not being in the body, what are the factors that contribute to that?
There are quite a few factors. Some are genetic, of course, and at this point in time, we can't really do much about that. Age is another factor. Most women go through menopause in their early 50s, but it can also be earlier, often because of medical interventions. For example, a hysterectomy and or an oophorectomy, which is the surgical removal of the uterus and or the ovaries. And unfortunately, there is evidence that having the uterus and more so the ovaries removed before menopause correlates with a higher risk of dementia in women, which is something that you're not usually told before that happens to you. And I just want to be clear, I'm not saying that women should decline the procedures or avoid the procedures if they need them. But I think we really need to better understand what happens to our brains as we go through menopause, natural or medical, and how to protect our brains in the process. And also something I was reading is that in the United States, one in every nine women has the uterus removed at some point in her life, which is a lot of women. And the number one reason for that is not something terrifying like cancer.
They have to do.
But it's fibroids.
Fibroids.
You know, perhaps modern medicine could come up with some better solutions than just removing your organs.
Well, we know the impact of an anti-inflammatory diet and lowering sugar and how that could potentially be something that could help with that.
Yes, there are quite a few. So lifestyle is another factor that plays a role in definitely hormonal health, but also menopause and how and when and how you go through menopause.
So let's expand on the lifestyle, because that's one of the things that we can actually control.
Yes, exactly.
It's something that we can do. Mm-hmm. So you had given this example of the people in your scans that were eating the Western diet versus not. Let's start off first with the lifestyle aspect of diet. What do we know about diet and its impact on hormones?
Right. So what we know about diet is that the foods we eat really have an impact on the health of our brains. And I think as a society, we're more comfortable with the notion that we feed our bodies and that the foods and diets that we choose will have an impact perhaps on our choice of clothing or our waists, our muscles. But we're less aware that we're also feeding our brains and that the nutrients that we put in our bodies will probably have an effect inside our heads as well. And I think it's really important to acknowledge the fact that foods also have an effect on hormones. Right? There's a strong correlation between diets, like you mentioned right now, and hormonal health to many different levels, whether obesity, diabetes, insulin resistance, thyroid disease, but also menopausal symptoms. So we really need to eat to optimize our health, not just the way we look, but also the way we think. And as a scientist who's really involved in women's health, I went through the research that's been done specifically in women, because we know that men and women need somewhat different diets, right? Because we have different hormones, we have different muscle fibers to some extent. I mean, we're not different beings, obviously, but there are some differences that could potentially explain why women crave chocolate more.
And differences at different ages, too.
And different
when you're
ages.
Young and you're a woman who's in her prime of fertility, you need a different, you might have different requirements.
More chocolate.
But
yeah,
like,
no, but
for
it's
instance,
true. More iron, more protein.
Sure. Yes. I've even heard like a lot of women who are young in like, you know, like let's say 25, like in the 25 to like 40 year old age and are still, they want to have kids. They haven't had kids yet. And they try like an extreme keto where they cut out all carbohydrates. Typically, we've gotten a lot of women that say, okay, it doesn't work the same way for me as it might work for a man, especially as a man, like at our clinic, at the Ultra Wellness Center. So there's so many areas where, even though we are similar, we're all human beings, that we do have to personalize things appropriately for women and men.
Yes, for sure. And we respond to diets very differently, also depending on the menstrual cycle, honestly, which is something that many diets just don't consider. So in the first part of the cycle, when your estrogen is really high, your metabolic activity is higher, so you can definitely tolerate more carbs, for example. In the second part of the cycle, where the estrogen goes down and the progesterone goes up, then you're going to need three times the same kind of stimulant, for example, to feel the same effect, which is when women have a tendency to perhaps overdo it a little bit with the chocolate. So there are a few physiological things that one needs to take into account. And I think the research is pointing to the research has pointed to the Mediterranean diet as a diet that seems to be really supportive of women's health. And I would argue that perhaps it's not just the diet as much as the lifestyle that is really lower stress, more consistent, low intensity physical activity, but you just keep your body moving all the time. And the food is definitely higher quality than in other, you know, societies, like when you go to Duane Reade and there's donuts everywhere. So it's perhaps a lifestyle that it seems to be more conducive to improve women's health. But it is interesting that the Mediterranean diet contains foods that are quite rich in estrogens in the form of phytoestrogens or estrogens from plants. So what's interesting is that estrogen is the most ancient of hormones, so it can really go across species. So the estrogen that the plant makes has a similar effect in a woman's body as our own estrogens, which is really nice. Now I think the nature works all together, and that we can get hormones from a plant and just they become part of our own hormonal system. I think it's quite nice. And of course, there are some phytoestrogens that have been associated with some health risks, like soy. Soy is perhaps the richest source of phytoestrogens, but many people have allergies to soy. And the soy that we have in the United States is very often genetically modified or very highly polluted, so it's perhaps not the best choice. But then there are other foods like flax seeds. They're a great source of estrogens from plants. Sesame seeds, chickpeas, mostly legumes, as well as dried apricots for some reasons, and a number of fruits. And also dark chocolate contains a form of phytoestrogen that is potentially biologically active in a woman's body.
So we know the Mediterranean diet, and we'll come and I want to talk about a few more things with the Mediterranean diet.
Okay.
Going back to some of the factors inside a diet, one of the things that we've definitely seen an increase of as diets all around the world have become more westernized, even in places like Italy and Europe and other places, everybody's sort of following the unfortunate trend that the United States has set, is we've seen a massive influx of sugar into a lot more foods. So what do we know about sugar and how it plays into a role with the items that you're talking about?
Well, so refined sugar wears out your pancreas, right? It really decreases your insulin sensitivity and increases your risk of insulin resistance. And insulin, being a hormone, works in balance with all your other hormones. So if you have hormonal imbalances, whether thyroid disease or insulin resistance, prediabetes, that might also impact your sex hormones and your reproductive functionality. So I think in general, I don't know if it's just sugar, but there's a lot of evidence that processed food is really not good news for health in general, but also especially for women's health. And there's this incredible study with 100,000, over 100,000 people that came out in the British Medical Journal showing how consistent consumption of processed food is associated with an increased risk of cancer, of all types of cancers, but also over 12% higher risk of cancer, of breast cancer, for postmenopausal women. Whereas there's another really big study showing that regular consumption of fish, especially fatty fish, and also legumes, is associated with a later onset of menopause. So anything that can delay the onset of menopause, I think, is beneficial to women in some ways.
I want to take it back to your personal journey, because when you are, I can imagine, going for your PhD is a very intensive time.
Yes, it was.
And you are coming from Europe, where things are much more inherently connected to the land and food, and you don't have to work as hard to get that.
Yeah.
And then in the US, there's a lot of bad habits that are here often.
Yeah.
How did you find in your own journey as you were going through this literature with those roots that you had of eating a Mediterranean diet, coming from, it sounds like, a very healthy family. How did that shift, or what did you become more aware of as you came to the U.S. when it came to your own health?
Well, I became acutely aware that chocolate chip cookies make you fat. We don't have them in Italy. And I moved to New York. I had no money as a PhD student. And all my friends were eating these enormous cookies. They were as big as pizza, and they were so fantastic. And they just went for it. You know, we don't have cafeteria style food in Italy. And that's all I was eating. And it completely, I couldn't recognize myself. Like, I gained so much weight, and I just could not think straight. And it took me a minute to realize that that was actually what I was eating. Because back then I was looking at genetics, I was looking at family history, I was looking like genetic mutations for Alzheimer's. Nobody was talking a lifestyle as something that could actually impact your brain, especially diet. It took a long time for the field to really say, yes, food has an effect on your brain and Alzheimer's risk. And so I was really not prepared for the effects of that diet on me. And my mom was the first, actually my dad was like, sweetheart, you know, we have to do something here. So try to go back to eating the way we used to. And then the weight went away, thank God. And I realized I had to go to a gym because I didn't get the kind of exercise that I used to get in Italy. Just little things, but like doing the stairs all the time. We have my parents live on the fourth floor of a walk-up. And it was very normal for me to just go up and down the stairs all day long. And here it's all elevators. So I was taking the elevators instead. And I wasn't walking that much. I was taking the subway. And so I really had to turn it around. And my brain responded so quickly, which is really what made me interested in lifestyle when other people were not quite talking about it yet.
That's fantastic. It's always interesting, our own personal experiences.
Yeah, traumatic.
And how they, traumatic and, yes. And how they impact our journey of what we're interested in. I mean, the whole reason that I got into health right. is because I had severe acne in high school. And I later on found that through just severe gut dysbiosis, I had intolerance to dairy. I wasn't lactose intolerant, but I had an inflammatory response. And so after cutting out dairy completely out of my diet, my acne completely went away.
Nice.
So it's always interesting the journey that we have and how that leads us to where we are.
Yeah.
So,
okay. I also heard that you have a problem with bell peppers. Is it possible? She mentioned that. Well, I do. I'm intolerant.
Yes. So I am very reactive to a lot of nightshades.
I get it.
So tomato, like excellent. If the skin is still on, bell peppers, I get very red. In my face. Who knows what the origin of that is, but yes, the things that we figure out about our health.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So when men or women come to you and talk to you about, okay, now I know the stats.
Right.
Women are more likely for X, Y, and Z and all the things that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast.
Yes.
And we know lifestyle factors contribute. And we know that they show up as early as our 40s, right? Like
yes,
later 30s,
can.
40s.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you tell, let's focus on women because that's what, you know, the angle is. And for the men that love them and are in their lives, what are the things that are the highest return that you have them start to focus on at that age to impact the likelihood of Alzheimer's and other degenerative brain diseases or brain tumors that might come later down in life?
Mm-hmm.
When you start off at the top in terms of like you usually prioritize this first and then and this next. I'm
That's
sure they all matter.
Yes. So I'm going to show you this very quickly. Where is it? What I usually tell them is this. There's a sentence in Latin that I'm sure you're familiar with, is mens sana in corpore sano, which means a healthy mind in a healthy body. And if you take just the beginning, mens sana, then you have M for mental stimulation, E for exercise, N for nutrition, S for sleep, we have another S for stress, A for avoiding toxins, another N for networks, and the final A for medical assessments.
And this is part of your eight-step plan that you put together. Can you explain what that's called? It's called the well-nourished brain.
Oh, the eight steps to a well-nourished brain. Yes.
That's the same thing as what you were talking about.
Yes, it is the same thing.
Or it's just a coincidence that they both have eight steps.
I think the eight steps is more like the diet.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, there are eight things that one can do to optimize their diet.
Let's talk about this one first.
These are eight things that people can actually do. And what I always say to our patients is that it's up to them to decide which one is most important to them, because we have some patients who are super healthy in terms of their diet and exercise levels, but they're so stressed out. They're shaking when they come to the office. They're under so much stress. They can't sleep at night. So for them, stress reduction and sleep management are really the absolute priorities. So I think it's really important to check these eight things and what are you doing okay already and what is not so great and
like
how can you make it better?
Link?
Yes, what's missing in your life at this point, and then let's try to address those. If I had to just choose three, My top three would be number one, diet, because we all, almost all of us, we eat three times a day. So we have three chances every day to really make,
how can you make it better?
Yes. Well, what's missing in your life? Exercise, number two. There's a ton of evidence that keeping your body going really also helps your brain staying young and healthier and makes it more resilient. And for women in particular, there is literature, there's research done specifically in women, and it did show, like you were saying, that age plays a big role in hormonal health as well. So when women are premenopause, their muscles, their energy levels, everything is more conducive to a higher level of intensity in terms of exercise. You don't have to do it, but you could. Whereas after menopause, it's a little bit more difficult to really engage in high intensity activities. And so many women just feel so bad about it. And they almost beat themselves up. So part of what I'm trying to do is to just say, it's okay. It's not about having a standard. It's not about following trends. It's really about what works for you and your body and your mind at this stage in your life. If you can't do spinning, it's okay. Just find something else that you like to do, but do it consistently. So what research has shown is that consistency is really key, rather than intense bursts of activity, and then it takes you 3 weeks to recover because your hormones are not there to help you out, and maybe you're so stressed that your cortisol is up to the roof and your adrenaline doesn't make you sleep. Just try to find an exercise that really helps you feel at your best. So that would be my number two. And number three would be stress reduction.
And that's a big word.
And which one?
It seems stress reduction like it's a simple word, but it's a big
it's
topic.
A huge one. Yes.
Because part of what you were saying before is that part of what may be influencing, kind of like the research in the blue zones, could be influencing the Mediterranean diet and how impactful it is just the Mediterranean lifestyle as a whole. So when you work with the women in New York at Cornell who are asking for the recommendations that are out there, or you're talking at different places and forums to audiences, and the topic of stress reduction comes up, how do we create a little miniature Italy in our own lifestyle and embrace that? What have you been the things that you've seen that are most impactful for people when it comes to stress reduction?
I think it depends on why you're stressed, right? There are many people in New York are stressed because of work. We all work very long hours. We have very little time for self-care. And I think there's research showing how for women also holding full-time jobs and having a family and raising small kids and taking care of the elderly parents and trying to perform as well as a man in the same position while being paid less. There are a lot of psychological stressors as well that really seem to peak when women are in the ages of 25 to 45, according to, I don't remember which enormous entity in the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. There's also evidence that women tend to suffer more stress than men, or at least they internalize stress perhaps more or have more symptoms because of the same levels of stress. And I think it's in part that women don't have a lot of time to really take care of themselves. Perhaps we're not good and making the time, but as a new mom, I can totally relate to that. I used to exercise very consistently, and then now I really had to plan for it. You know, you just don't have that hour and a half that you just, I'll just drop off at the gym, and nope, no more. Now you go to the playground. It's a really difficult, it's a different life that you have at some point, and it's a beautiful life. It's just really important, I think, to find ways to reduce stress that work for every individual woman, and everybody's different in many ways. Yoga is something that works for a lot of people. Meditation has been shown in clinical trials to really reduce cortisol levels in stressed out women, including those going through menopause. So it's a good thing to know. Green time over screen time. You know, doing this kind of weekends without social media, or try not to check your email before bedtime, try to really optimize your sleep, trying to sleep longer if you need to, or at least to sleep better so that you're not disrupted when you're sleeping. There are a number of things then.
So you mentioned something earlier, and I'd just like you to hypothesize, or if you have any literature to reference to.
Okay.
Why is it, I've heard this a few times for some guests on the podcast, you said that there seems to be some research that women internalize stress more than one, on a whole. And everybody's different. Different people are different, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But do you have any thoughts as to what could be some of the contributing factors that lead to that? Is it societal pressures? Is it, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. But I think what makes sense to me is research from sociology showing how men and women have somewhat different ways to react to stress. We all have the flight or fight response, right? Where you're under threat and then you either punch the threat in the face or run for the hills. In women, what happens is that, yes, you do have that initial response, but it's a little bit blunted because at the same time, we get a surge of oxytocin, which is the love hormone that makes you actually reach out to people and tend and befriend. It's called the reaction that is specific to women. The anti-stress reaction for women is the tend and befriend response that seems to have developed a really long time ago when our ancestors still lived in very primitive societies and the men would go out hunting. So they needed to have a really strong fight or flight reaction because they were the ones who went chasing other animals or procuring food, you know, they were more exposed to dangers. Whereas women would would stay back and take care of the children and the grandparents and were more like gathering whatever they could in the environment. But it made more sense for women to really help each other out in times of stress, right? Bonding. And asking other women for help because it's really hard to fight when you have a little baby that you're holding. You can't really run for the same exact reasons. So it made sense to really gang up and perhaps chase the tiger away with sticks and stones and whatnot. But it looks like that response somehow got wired into our limbic system. And there are specific parts of a woman's brain that are more interconnected with the frontal cortex, which is in charge of reacting. They kind of shut down in times of stress because of the oxytocin release. So I think what happens to women today is that, yes, you can reach out to other women for help, but very often you don't have time, or to your husband or to your friends and family. But very, very often you just don't have the time to do that. You just soldier on and keep going, and you don't have the time to just have a 3 hours long conversation where you're really venting or, you know, going out shopping with your friends. And that might be that we just don't know how to get this stress relief that we need.
That maybe in the past, if I'm hearing you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong. So what I'm hearing is that maybe in the past, through our evolutionary biology, that, again, broad generalizations, but that women would solve challenges, face problems in the community of others,
yes,
and would reach out. And that was part of their ability to cope and deal with stress. Mm-hmm. And not having that in the way that we don't live in villages the way that we did before, these tight-knit families that are all in one, under one roof, that the impact of stress that's now happening solo because of modern society causes, could potentially leave women with more of the feeling that the stress is on their own shoulders and they don't have anybody to reach out to.
Right. And there's some research with brain scans showing that women's brains really kind of flare up in times of stress, whereas women's brains kind of shut down in a way where maybe you'll just go to the gym and work out and feel better quickly. Like if you can get some kind of intense stress relief activity, that really helps a lot for men, but not much so for women. So I think we just need to find stress relief techniques that work better for men and for women by looking at genders differently.
And this goes back to your core thing that we're talking about here on the podcast, is that if we're not researching,
yes,
then we don't know. We
yes.
can't assume that what works for one works for another. Sometimes it does. And of course, women should honor their own intuition.
Right.
And not just feel like they have to do something that somebody else is doing, because maybe that research was based on research around men?
Well, actually it was. You know, all the research on the flight or fight response was mostly based on studies in men.
Wow.
Which is part of the bikini medicine thing we were talking about, but also the fact that women were actually excluded from research for so many years because there was it was thalidomide. I don't know if you knew that. It's this drug that was given to pregnant women to deal with symptoms.
Yes.
And then it turns out that it created a lot of health issues in the babies, right. Deformities, and a lot of other problems. And the FDA took a cautionary stance, which makes perfect sense, and said that women of childbearing age, which is any woman from puberty through menopause, should not be included in experimental clinical trials. Which, again, makes sense, because if you don't know the side effects of a drug, it is perhaps a good idea to avoid giving it to pregnant women, at least, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of escalated to the point that women were just excluded from research, period.
Mm.
And if you're not participating in research, you're not informing research either. So for decades, most clinical trials were really in men, were done in men. And so a lot of the recommendations and a lot of the medical knowledge that we have still today is really based on research in men. And that is a problem when certain things just don't work for women, right? Like Ambien, the sleep drug, women were getting overdosed.
Yeah, no, expand on that, please, because I don't know if everybody in our podcast is familiar with that. So
Ambien is the most common sleep medication in the United States. And it's metabolized differently in women than in men, in that women metabolize the drug faster. And nobody really thought about that. They knew it, but they didn't think it was such a big problem. And so women were getting the same dose of Ambien as men. But then a number of doctors and scientists reported that just wasn't reasonable, because women were literally killing themselves by sleepwalking in the morning or driving a car while still kind of being a bit drugged. And so there were so many reports of car accidents driven by women who just had taken the Ambien the night before just to try and sleep, but they still had this drug in their bloodstream. And so after many doctors and scientists really went knocking on the door of the FDA and said, you have to do something about that, then the drug was reevaluated, and now women are given half the dose that's given to men.
Wow.
But for many years, women just overdosed on Ambien just because the drug was not dosed correctly for women.
Mm.
Or even, did you know that female Viagra was tested in 23 men?
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. It's just so bizarre.
So there was one item on that list that you showed on that based on the Latin inspiration of the word.
Yeah.
And it was toxins.
Toxins, yes.
Let's talk about toxins a little bit. Mm-hmm. How do toxins impact our risk of some of these chronic diseases?
Right. So it's a great question. And I have to be clear that there is no consensus on that in the scientific world, if you will. Some people believe that toxins are bad for your brain. Some people just do not believe it. I'm one of those who happens to believe it. And we know that there are substances that are usually man-made chemicals that act like estrogens in the body, but they're like the evil twin of the estrogen. So they really increase the side effects of estrogens, for example, in patients with perhaps cancer or predisposition to cancer. And they're called xenoestrogens or foreign estrogens, which are made by us and not by nature. And for
plastics and BPA.
Plastics, for sure. And now the American Endocrine Society actually put out a position statement where they also acknowledge these estrogen disrupting compounds as a health hazard, especially for women, especially pregnant women and children of all ages. And it's been shown that these compounds can have really negative effects on hormonal health, like a thyroid function, but also on fertility, and in a number of reproductive issues in both men and women, especially children. So for me personally, as a woman and as a mom of a little girl, it is really important to avoid toxins as much as I can. For me, that means eating organic as much as I can. And I'm very much aware that it's expensive. It's more expensive than not eating organic. But personally, I'd rather invest in health than, than something else. Like, I prioritize health. I don't care about having a fancy car or going to a fancy vacation. I'd much rather eat healthy food. So that's my personal choice. Plastic, like you said, is a gigantic issue. We're literally drowning in plastic. And many plastics contain these sort of compounds that literally leak in your food as you reheat the plastic, or as the food just happens to be sitting in these containers for a long enough amount of time. So it's really also important to possibly switch to glass or other safer household tools or cookware as much as possible. Makeup could be an issue. Things like deodorants could be an issue. Toothpaste. Some toothpastes contain dioxytitanium. Why? Why is there titanium in your toothpaste? So, you know, there are quite a few things we can...
And going back to what you were originally saying is that there's not always consensus. And part of the reason there's not consensus is very difficult to study.
Yes.
The long-term impact of these toxins that are there. It's very difficult to know their ability. I mean, I think that if you look at the history of lead, you'll see that even recently, the understanding of like how much lead is an acceptable amount of lead, and then finally the understanding of like no lead is acceptable in the body due to our deeper understanding of the science that's out there.
But, you know, I think it's really important that people start talking about it. Because if people demand information, then scientists are given a chance to find out if the information is right or wrong. Right? So it's really important that men and women really demand accurate information for their health. Because the government listens. They really do. It can take a little while, but eventually they will fund the research to provide the answers. Hopefully. Then, of course, it depends on which administration we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that part of that, separate from administration and politics, part of that is raising the awareness to know what questions to ask.
Right.
To know what questions to ask so that you can start looking in the right direction. Right. So from what we've shared so far, for somebody who's looking to take the beginning steps of going down the pathway of improving their life, fundamentally when it comes to the XX brain, right, and the book, what is one important question that women and men, again, you know, I hate to put it that way, but again, let's talk about women, can start asking when it comes to finding the right partner in a healthcare, like in a healthcare provider? Like, because some of these things are so new. We often know like that it can take 12 to 17 years before the medical literature that's out there and understood is implemented at the hospital level.
Oh, yeah.
So there's people that are listening that are out there like, wow, this is really interesting. And like, you know, the references, I'll just give an example. The references that come back on a lab result around, around hormone levels or just even blood work in general, they're just based on the average population. They're not necessarily looking at what's optimal for that individual that's at that specific age that's out there. So part of this is there's so many things you can do on your own. Part of this there, you might need to work with a practitioner or individual that's out there.
Absolutely.
Any tips or guidance for people that are looking for the right partner in crime?
It's a really good question. I think, first of all, really understanding your symptoms is a great first step. Like, some women are concerned about menopause, and the question is, do I go to an OBGYN or do I go to an endocrinologist? Right? There's, I'm concerned about Alzheimer's prevention. Do I go to a neurologist? Do I go to a neuropsychologist? Do I go to a psychiatrist? Who do I go to? So I have a whole thing in the book that is really about find the doctor that is right for you. And there are a lot of directions there. Of course, the focus of my book is about women and Alzheimer's prevention in women. So it focuses on that, but there's also links to professional societies with lists of medical professionals that are particularly good for one thing or the other. So that could be a good first step. Number one, identify what concern you have most. And your GP may not be the best person to address all these concerns, although it's certainly good to ask your GP for a referral. But also it's good to look around and see who is being recommended by whom as well.
Let's talk about the center and some of the research that's coming up or what you're excited
right,
about.
Right, or come to us.
Yes, yes.
That's another option. That's another option.
Tell us about some of the things at the center that yes. is coming down the horizon. What are you guys working on next?
Yes.
And what is your hope to study in the coming future?
Ooh, that's great. So when I launched the Women's Brain Initiative, it was me and two research assistants. And now we are 25.
And can I pause for one
yes.
second? Because so much of this space, a lot of people weren't talking about prevention.
Right.
Who is an advocate for you in the beginning, in the creation of the center?
Huh.
Like, how did it even come to being?
Ooh. Okay, so for years, I was applying for grants to look at women's brains, and I really learned how to take a good rejection well. Like, I just got rejected, rejected, rejected. And then more recently, the field really came together, and now also, I think, also in part because the work that we published showing that there are indeed real differences between men's brains and women's brains in the way we age and in the way that we experience Alzheimer's risks and vulnerabilities to other conditions as well. But I finally got funded. So I went from like zero grants to look at women's brains. I always had grants, obviously, but not to look at women's brains. And now I have 11, which is incredible.
It's massive. And who was the first grant from?
The NIH. The National Institute on Health.
And that's where it yes. goes back to what you were saying, that the government would listen.
The government was listening. We finally had compelling evidence. And then I went to my chairman, Dr. Matt Fink at Weill Cornell. He's the chairman of neurology. And I said, I really want to do the Women's Brain Initiative. And he said, you know what? Let's do it. You convinced me. Have my full support. Let's do it. So it was really great. And after that, Maria Shriver really helped. Her women's Alzheimer's movement gave us two grants over time, and then the Cure Alzheimer's Fund also gave us a big grant. And then I got a really big private donation that led to more donations. And that I think what really made a huge difference for me was the media and being able to do podcasts and writing books so that more people got to learn about research much more easily. Mm. It's very hard for a scientist to talk to you. Seriously, it's
true. You're doing a pretty good job. Well, you've had
a
lot of practice.
To have the chance yes, to do a podcast or to be on the Today Show.
Right, they're in their own
world.
It's
really difficult. Yeah. We're not great at talking.
And oftentimes, it's not encouraged. It's not encouraged
it's
to go and
discouraged.
Talk because it sounds like you are doing advocacy science. Instead of, but the truth is that how do we build a movement? We have to go to the people. We
yes.
have to get the people to be excited.
Yes.
You never know who's listening to this podcast who gives the next grant.
That's there.
So you went direct to the public by doing
yes.
media
yes.
and TED Talks as well.
Yes, I'm excited
You've
about
had some,
that one.
You have a TED Talk coming up?
It's coming out soon, March 10th.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And I think it's an important lesson for everybody is that sometimes when there's gatekeepers, just go direct to the source, go to the people.
Yeah, as scientists, we're really not trained to talk to the public. And for me, it was really Maria Shriver who made a huge difference.
She's
doing
such
a wonderful
work,
woman.
Team.
Yes, she's incredible, and she's such an incredible Alzheimer's advocate. And She's just passionate about women's brains and supporting other women, especially women scientists, because she fully understands how unprepared we are to really speak to the public. And I remember the first time that I met her and they invited me to talk about their research at this event. And
was it their annual fundraiser that they do? Or
no, it was an event she was doing in New York. It was like a brain health awareness.
Oh, right. They did one in New York, Boston. And they did a few different cities.
Yes, it was beautiful, really well organized. And she asked me to talk about her work on menopause. And then as I was talking, she would just say, okay, I'm going to stop you right here. Are you trying to say that? And I was like, yeah, that's perfect. And it was just, I mean, you know her. So it was perfect that she did that.
She was helping you just translate.
Yeah, just translate.
From science to layman's.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really, really hard. It's really, you want to be accurate, but you also want people to understand what you're saying.
Because and prevention is all about action.
It is all about action.
You want them to take action. You want them to understand that.
You want to inspire people and really give them a reason to believe that they can make it.
Yes.
Yes. At the same time, you don't want other scientists to think that you're not accurate or that, you know, you've been too commercial, in quotes.
Have you had any pushback on your work? Of course, you talked about all the rejection that's out there.
Yes.
And how do you, on a personal level?
Well, meditation helps, for sure. I think a few years ago, you would find me like literally up against the wall, like... Now I just understand that it happens. It just happens. I don't take it personally. I just do my best to really provide all the information and all the validation. I went from publishing a lot of papers to really focusing on things that are very new and spending more time on developing new data and testing new theories. There are different types of scientists. There are the scientists who focus on one thing and just keep doing the same thing over and over and just go bigger and bigger. Like you start with 100 people, then you go to 500, then 1,000, but you're basically just either testing other people's ideas with large data sets or just refining a theory, which is great. But then there are scientists more like me who really take chances, and it takes time to take chances, and you can just find nothing.
You might strike out and nothing comes up.
Nothing comes up. And then you lost 2 years of work. But so far, it's going okay. In fact, I wanted to just mention this because I think you really like it.
Please.
When you said that we can measure hormones in blood, you were saying, well, you know, you want to go to a doctor and you have your labs done. We're not good at measuring hormones. We're really not good. The reference values are enormous. Like for estradiol levels, if you test within 30 and 300 picograms, you're okay, right? Which is a huge variation.
The reference range is very wide.
Yes, it's very wide, and that's in blood. And what I keep telling my patients is that those tests will not predict your symptoms of menopause and will not predict how well you respond to hormonal therapy, because your hormone levels in blood are not correlated with your hormones in your brain. Mm. They're two different systems that, of course, speak to each other and are in constant communication with each other, but the hormones inside your brain follow their own criteria because they're not just about reproduction. They're also about a number of other things inside your brain that have nothing to do with whether or not you're fertile or pregnant and whatnot, but they really are needed by the brain to do different things. And we don't have a tool that allows us to measure these hormones in brain. So when women are put on hormone replacement therapy or any kind of hormonal therapy, it's really guesswork because you can't measure it inside a woman's brain. So you don't know where to start, when to start, you know when to stop, and you don't know how much hormones to give because you can't dose it. And so one thing that we're doing now, speaking of taking risks,
yes,
is that we developed a tool to do that. So we now have an imaging technique that will allow us to measure hormones in a woman's brain as soon as we hear back from the FDA. Wow. It's with the FDA right now, so fingers crossed.
That's incredible. And to start off, for those that are interested in the topic or maybe have even gone through it, right, hormone replacement therapy,
yes,
top level until you can dial into being able to measure it better,
yes,
what are your top line thoughts about it? What's safe about it? What's not safe about it? What are your just opinions right now from what you've seen that are out there?
So my opinion is that hormonal replacement therapy, or now we call it menopausal hormonal therapy, MHT, has gone through different phases. There was a phase where the hormones became available and everybody got really excited, and then every woman was taking these hormones in massive doses and forever. Then the NIH caught up with the practice. And they said, well, but we really need to test these hormones in clinical trials. And so they started the Women's Health Initiative back in the 1990s. And they had 40,000, 7,000 or more women in these clinical trials. And what they showed was that the hormones were actually increasing risk of heart disease, of strokes, or blood clots, of dementia, and in some women also of cancer.
Yeah, it was groundbreaking. I remember that there was a ton of aunts and other people that were in my family that were on hormone replacement therapy, and then the studies came out, and then like everybody kind of pulled back.
Right. And they just went cold turkey overnight. They just stopped taking the hormones, and then there were a bunch of lawsuits, right, kicked off. And then hormones were the devil, and nobody was touching anymore. Nobody was prescribing them. Now I think we are in a better place in that we understand that those early clinical trials were not perfect to start with because the women in the trials were too old. They were like 10, 20 years post-menopause. And what we know about hormones is that it's a system, right? So you have the hormones that acts like a key in a lock. So you have the hormones and then you need to have a receptor for the hormones. And then the hormones lock to the receptor, and then it's the receptor that triggers a cascade of things that are usually good for you, like energy production or immunity or growth and whatnot. But once the estrogens are not there for a certain amount of time, the receptors shut down. And you can't reopen them. Mm. Once they're done, they're done.
There's no lock, but there's a key, but there's no lock.
There's a key, but the lock is jammed.
Yeah.
Right? And so just putting the key in there, in that case, doesn't help your brain. It doesn't help you with the system, with the symptoms that you have, but it can create a number of side effects because at that point, your arteries are harder because you're maybe 70 years old. And we know the estrogen replacement can actually increase the risk of ischemia or blood clots. So instead of preventing heart disease, it can actually make it worse. So basically, just to summarize 20 years of headaches, really, starting hormonal therapy more than 6 years after menopause is not helpful at all. It can actually increase the risk of problems in the brain. If you start hormonal therapy within 6 years of the onset of menopause, it looks like it might help with things like hot flashes or night sweats. It doesn't seem to have an effect on cognitive health. It doesn't improve your cognitive performance, at least as far as we know. We have no idea if starting before menopause actually works, which is something that I would be very interested in testing, especially now that as soon as we have this imaging technique that would allow us to test if the lock is open or not, right? That's what we need to know. The state of your brain. Is your brain receptive to these hormones? And the only way to know is to actually look at it. Mm. So I'd be really interested to see if this window of opportunity is a little bit earlier in the process of menopause.
Fascinating.
It is actually. And I honestly find it offensive that so many women were put on hormones before anyone thought, well, you know what, we actually need to measure what we're doing, or we need to be able to monitor what we're doing, and it hasn't been done. And I just find it to be this whole problem with women's health. They were not thinking creatively about women's brains. We're just kind of, well, I'll just give you the hormones and hopefully you'll be fine.
And do you think that that was the attitude that led to that?
No, I don't know if it was the attitude, but I do think that we haven't done a good job at really addressing women's brain health.
Yeah, and probably at the, that was back in like the 90s, right? Like when did the NIH give the approval that, okay, we got to start doing this clinical trial?
1993.
So probably at that time, there's probably less women in leadership roles that were choosing and making these decisions and at these drug companies. And so when you don't have women in the room,
that's talking about women's health. That's a
really good point. And, that's why we have to raise the awareness.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's why it's so exciting that more women than men are graduating in the sciences that are out there. And it's really together by hosting that conversation that things can change.
Yes, and so much of this process is really happening because of men. And men in positions of power who actually care about women's health as well. The director of the NIH just recently said that he was not going to give any more talks at conferences that didn't have a good gender balance among the speakers because women are not speakers enough. And then there aren't enough female speakers at scientific conferences, which is a matter of fact. And there are a number of reasons for that. One reason being that women perhaps are invited and they can't go. Why? Because the conference doesn't provide a honorarium, for example, or because there is no childcare available, or for a number of reasons that just prevent many women to be there, right? It's not like we're not good enough to be invited.
Of course.
We should also make sure that women are able to attend.
Yeah, so well said. It's really teamwork. It's everybody who's progressive working together to make sure that women, minorities, everybody across the table are included and are part of
and
the conversation.
And also another thing I would love to mention is that we need more men to be part of the research now that we're finally looking at genders differently. Right? Like I have a 3,000 women waiting list for the Women's Brain Initiative, which is fantastic, and hopefully we'll be able to accommodate everyone. But we also need men to really show that what we're looking at, what we're finding, happens to women and not to men, right? And then, yes, I'm looking at women because of my family history and because nobody looks at women's brains and because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women, but the other third of patients are actually men, right? So we need to understand the risk factors that are most important for women and the risk factors that are most important to men. In my research, what we're seeing is that the risk factors for Alzheimer's that are more impactful for women are mostly hormonal and metabolic. But for men, they're more cardiovascular, like small vessel disease in the brain is a big risk factor for Alzheimer's and dementia in men. But we need more men to really better refine the findings and make them useful for clinical practice. So if any man or woman is interested in informing research and participating in research, we would be so grateful.
And they can go, and this is specifically when you're saying men, you need more men, you're not just talking generally, you're saying at your actual clinic.
Yes.
Yes.
At the clinic.
And if people want to sign up and put their name on the waiting list or join in, men or women, where would they go to do that?
So if you Google Weill Cornell Women's Brain Initiative, our contact information is right there. And it's enough to just pick up the phone and call. I have 5 research assistants who are ready to take the calls. Sending an email is probably even better because we're much faster at responding to emails. To get in touch with me through my website, which is lisamascani.com, or Instagram, I get a lot of
DMs.
Messages. Yes, which is wonderful. And then I just redirect anybody who's interested to the right contact person. Also, I want to stress that we do not charge. We don't take insurance. We don't charge patients. It's completely for free. We take care of everything. We cover everything except transportation. Unfortunately, I don't have a budget for that. But everything else we provide, including, really thorough medical evaluations, cognitive testing, lab tests, hormonal panels, menopause or andropause. conversations, we didn't think about that, consultations, and the brain scans. So it's really like $25,000 worth of medical evaluations.
Wow.
And no cost to participants.
And when people are at the clinic, do they also get recommendations?
Yes, if they want to. If they want to. Yeah. Yes, if they don't want to, that's totally fine.
That's incredible.
We do is that we collect all the data, and then we review all the information. As I mentioned, we're 25 people, and everybody contributes. You know, I'm with the brain scans, and then I have a neuroradiologist who looks at small brain, you know, small vessel disease in the brain. We have gynecologists, we have endocrinologists, we have cardiologists, we have a bunch of neurologists, psychiatrists. So everybody really looks at the data, and then we talk about it all together. And then we call the participants back and share the results as much as possible. Some results, because they're research only, so it's really hard to talk about those, but everything else we share, and we're happy to provide some recommendations, or in case there's something urgent to address, we also actually provide medical care in the hospital. We're set up at Weill Cornell to just refer patients to the right person for follow-up or anything else. You wouldn't believe how many people have something in their brains they actually need taken care of now.
Wow.
Yes, it's a lot of people.
And the brain scans that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
for people that are not part of your research,
mm.
do you recommend that there's resources out there that if they want to get brain scans done?
No, they can't.
Yeah.
The only way is to be part of research.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are other centers who do some of the brain scans that we do, but you can't just go to your doctor.
Right.
And ask for a brain scan. Unless you have symptoms. Unless you have symptoms of cognitive impairment or dementia.
Yeah. I know out of pocket there's some centers like Amen Clinics and other stuff that do certain types of brain scans, but nothing that you would, you know, it's very difficult, right? Because the cost of the testing and everything right now. So we just kind of have to wait or be part of the research that your guys are doing.
Well, the hope is that we'll be able to show that these brain scans actually have value for prevention. And once you show that, then I'm hoping that they'll become part of everybody's regular medical checkups at some point or the other.
Which is super important, because what you're saying is that there's women who are coming in, they may not necessarily be symptomatic yet, but they're like subclinical. They haven't been diagnosed, but there's something in their brain that you're finding. Yes. Or men, because you see some men too.
And men, of course. Yes. Oh, we have plenty of men. And
then you refer them out to a practitioner who might be able to help.
Right.
Them.
So if we're talking about dementia prevention, we have an Alzheimer's prevention clinic.
Yes.
Right there. So it's literally across the street. If we're talking like brain cancer or aneurysms, strokes, ischemia, microbleeds, those are all things we can treat directly in the department.
Got it.
So, yes, and now people are like, what? What? What do you have in your brain?
That's great. Mm-hmm. It's fully vertically integrated. So the book, The XX Brain, is coming out March 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your hope for the book for people that are out there? Like, who is really the person that you want to pick up this book?
Oh, any woman, really any woman. My hope for this book is really to empower women to better understand their brains and to really take control of their health, especially their brain health. And the reason I wrote the book is really to take the research out of the lab and out of the clinic and make it actionable for people. So I divided the book into three different parts. The first part is really the research that we've been talking about. And I think it's so important to understand what's been done so far and why women's brains have been neglected and what we all should do as women to avoid that from happening again and to actually have research that is specifically focused on our brains, because we need more. It can't be just a few scientists here and there. It should really be all research able to look at differences between the genders. And then the second part is the testing. I really clarify which numbers you need to know about yourself. You have to know your numbers and which numbers are really important in terms of prevention and treatment in case you do have something that needs treating. And then the last part is what you can do. And I think the question I get the most is about hormonal therapy. Should I take hormones or I took hormones, was that a mistake? They always say, it depends. It really depends. I need to have a lot of information on a woman to be really able to advise her. And that's when I think having a doctor that you really trust and respect and work well with is so important. But in the book, I have a number of tests that one can take directly in the book to identify, at the very least, the things that concern the greatest symptoms, perhaps, or the greatest risks for you as a person. And then I even have, like, because I'm a scientist, of course, but I have diagrams.
Yeah.
That, like, flow charts that lead you to a solution. Like, do you have hot flashes? Yes or not? Are you eligible to take this medication, right? And then there's a table that shows you if you are eligible or not. Mm-hmm. Yes or not? Do you have these symptoms? Yes or not? And it keeps going until you have a solution,
yeah,
right?
Like,
you're not eligible for hormonal therapy. Try therapy with SSRIs or SNRIs, or try a gabapentin, or try da-da-da, which is really closer to this precision medicine approach that we use at the clinic and at the Women's Brain Initiative, where we look at each person's individual risk factors and we try to personalize the solution. And of course, that's just one chapter in a book, and it's just the first step. But I think it really answers a lot of questions. Like, if you're older than X number of years and you went through menopause 7 years ago, should you be on hormones? Probably not, you know. And then let's look at other things that you can do. And then there's the whole lifestyle.
Because we have to be, all of us as human beings, we have to be the CEO of our health. And then we have to find the right implementers. You have to find the right doctor, the right person, the right therapist that's there. But if you're not informed, it's hard to ask good questions.
It is.
And really reading books like this is a great way to get more informed so you know what's out there.
Yes, that is my hope, to really clarify what we know about women's brains and about treatments for women, so that then women can really find the best treatment path or the best prevention path, or just optimize their own cognitive health for a wonderful long life.
I want to close off on this. You know, we were talking about how women's bodies have some complexities that are different.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And oftentimes in modern society, from all the way from a young girl who just is going through puberty and getting her period for the first time, there's a little bit of the conversation that's in women's, in health in general, of like, this is an annoyance, or it's something that's bad that's there. And when we started off with the stats that we read, that women are twice as more likely for this and anxiety and that thing, for women who are listening out there that feel like, oh my gosh, like all this stuff is just affecting like us, right? Like we have it so tough already. And then the pay gap and the other stuff, you know, it's easy to feel kind of like the future is bleak.
Oh no.
But I feel like you have a different message that's out there, and how these challenges are not like a negative on women. They're actually a sign of something super positive. So I'd love you to talk about that.
Yes, and that's such a good point, because I always feel like, oh my goodness, this is such a downer for women. But I don't mean it in that way, for sure. I think it's just really important to be aware that when women tell you that they're having a problem, it is a natural problem. And so many doctors sometimes just quite, you know, kind of, you're fine. Here, do you need antidepressants? You know, that just happens so often. So it's really important to me as a scientist to validate what women have been saying for centuries, that there are changes that happen in the body and in the brain that really mean that whoever is telling you that they're having trouble, number one, it's real. They're not making it up. It's true. And number two, they need the time to adjust and get better. And we live in a day and age where everything is so rushed, but our bodies and brains were not built to change in 5 minutes, right? So I think as women, it's just so important to be kind to ourselves and to be gentle with ourselves, and not just understanding better how we're working or how our bodies and brains work, but also how we can optimize our health, because we are at this point in history where there's so much that we can do about prevention, and there's so much that we know about prevention in women, which is really what the book is about, is this research that nobody really talks about, but it's there, it's been done. We just don't get to hear about it. And so by learning what works for other women and what other women found that it was helpful to them, you know, what choices other women made and perhaps what mistakes other women make, we can all learn from each other and from the science and really, really be healthier. And I think that's the most important thing, you know, that there are so many things that make women unique. And we're really working to make sure that their brain health is one of those.
So one important point that is there in the work, and you talk about this in the book, is how even though women are at more risk of some of these diseases that we started off with and these ailments at the beginning of the podcast, this does not mean that their performance is impacted. Can you talk about that?
Right. And thank you for asking. Yes. So I really want to clarify this because I wouldn't want anyone to think that middle-aged women might be underperformers, right? So we looked into cognitive performance and we found absolutely no differences between men and women before and after menopause, which is important information to have because as a woman, especially if you're having some trouble or perhaps you're pregnant, you have a baby brain, or you're going through menopause or perimenopause and you feel like you're actually losing your mind, I want to reassure everyone as a scientist that your IQ is unchanged.
It's such an important note because the feelings are real in the body.
Yes.
The feelings are real that women are feeling, but then the fear that they will be judged by society or their workplace, that their performance, she's got baby brain, she's not going to perform as well.
Right, and I don't want anyone to discriminate against women because of our findings that there are these changes in a woman's brain. I just want to say the brain needs the time and the support to adjust. Okay, so it's just a phase, whether it's the baby brain or amnesia or the pregnant brain or perimenopause, the brain just needs time and support.
Well, you mentioned the clinic and we'll link it up in the show notes and people can obviously Google it too. How can people find out more about you? You mentioned social media, Instagram.
Yeah, I'm only on Instagram. I'm too sensitive for Twitter. I just can't do Twitter. So on Instagram, my handle is Dr. Dr. Mosconi, M-O-S-C-O-N-I. And there's my website, which is lisamosconi.com. I think that's the best way.
And you know, you said you're too sensitive for Twitter.
Yeah, I can't.
And I think the thing is that there's so much just noise that's there. Mm-hmm. In terms of if somebody wants to just pick a fight,
yeah,
the way that it's set up is not really organized for like real communication. Like, I'm too sensitive for Twitter.
Oh, right? Well, like, that makes me feel better.
It's not the place, you know? It's not the place for like real conversation and dialogue to happen. It's a little bit more reactive, I would say. And
There's no filters.
Yeah, there's no filters. Really? And it's just a different tone of a conversation. So, Hey, I'm sensitive for Twitter too. Dr. Lisa Mosconi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
You mentioned this book is for women, but it's really for everybody.
Yes.
You know, as somebody who has had a chance to preview it in preparation of our interview, I want to say that if you have a loved one in your life, anybody that you care about, especially the women in your life, this is fascinating. And
thank
so
you.
Thank you for putting incredible work out there and coming on the Broken Brain Podcast to talk about all the beautiful things that you're doing at your center.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search there, find a provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.